Les colloques du Collège de France.
So, Sarah Willem, you are teaching in the University of Connecticut. You are specialized in global health anthropology, I would say. You have received a prestigious virtual prize for critical anthropology on global health. And you conducted some interesting studies about the COVID crisis and its impact, its impact on inequalities on the diverse populations involved in this crisis. And so we are very pleased to hear you now. Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us for today's challenging conversation. And I want to begin by actually dedicating my presentation to the memory of my friend Tali Kritzman-Amir, who would have been very comfortable on this stage. She was an extraordinary legal scholar and human rights activist from Israel who died of cancer 1 year ago at age 43. Her groundbreaking work, including an important paper on otherness as the underlying principle of Israel's migration regime, braided together two modes of critique that Didier Fassin, the organizer of today's gathering, describes as interrelated, if not interdependent. First, cognitive critique that can disrupt and dismantle misguided forms of common sense. And second, social critique around struggles for justice. And Tali paid a price for critiquing Israel's mistreatment of asylum seekers and other people it defined as others, including accusations of being, and these are her words, out of touch with reality, ignoring the dangers of life in Israel, being a dreamer, an idealist, and she took care to note that's not a compliment, but a term for someone who is unrealistic, naive, and immature. Unbothered by these accusations, she was committed to showing, and again I draw on Fassin, how analyzing inequality can make the social world intelligible anew and offer new possibilities for intervention. And so it's in this spirit that I aim in my work and in my remarks today to illuminate some of the structural logics that constrain political vision and moral imagination in Israel, and more broadly in the region of Israel-Palestine, with a particular focus on global migrants who've been constructed by Israel as racialized others. And I should say from the outset that I expect that probably everyone in this room will be uncomfortable with at least something that I say today. And if so, and if this discomfort provokes deeper reflection, then I will consider my presentation to have been a success. So I offer these reflections as an invitation to see this fraught region and its inhabitants, old and new, through a new lens. I'm an ethnographer, so I need to begin with a story. And it's a story of a brief but memorable exchange that took place during a mass deportation campaign that was launched by the Israeli government in 2002 on the basis of a flawed but seductive claim: 300,000 unemployed Israelis, 300,000 migrant workers. And I'll say more about that deportation campaign in a moment. Now, this story took place at a peculiar gathering, a public meeting held in an improvised church that was convened by Israel's newly formed immigration police, with the goal of convincing migrant workers and their families to leave Israel of their own accord through what it described as a voluntary departure arrangement. About 100 migrants attended this meeting, and I attended as well as an ethnographer, and most of them were West African men. After the immigration police gave their proposal, it was time for questions, and a Nigerian man I'll call Emeka stood in the back of the hall, microphone in hand, and in a booming voice, he appealed to the immigration police officers for mercy and for empathy, invoking a logic of racialized otherness that he presumed the police officers would share. Here's what he said. He said, "We are not terrorists. We are not Palestinians. We are not against you. We came here for a purpose, just like migrant workers all over the world. Do not treat us with stony hearts. We are not criminals, even if we are illegal. We are human, irrespective of the fact that we are black. There's so much we could discuss about this comment. Now, a top-ranking officer in the city's in the immigration police, who was known to the city's African migrant community by first name, and I'll call him Rafi, jumped in to respond, and here's what he said. He said, "We think you are good people." And he said this in English that was staccato and rough, but he was quick to respond. "We don't think that you are criminals. If we thought you were criminals, we wouldn't face you like this." Now, this brief exchange reveals quite a bit, I think, about the dynamics of racialization, criminalization, and othering in Israel, and about how racialized borders that were already in existence were reconfigured and contested during the mass deportation campaign that I witnessed more or less firsthand. The migrants targeted by this campaign had begun arriving in Israel from across the global south in the 1990s, largely in the wake of the First Intifada, most of them seeking work. None had arrived via Israel's law of return, the law that grants Israeli citizenship to anyone with a bureaucratically legible tie to Jewishness, while excluding virtually all others. Now, in the summer of 2002, these new arrivals were quickly reframed by the Israeli government as a major social, economic, and political problem in need of a solution. And then over the next 3 years, over 150,000 migrants, or about half the migrant workers living in Israel at the time, were either deported or essentially intimidated into leaving on what was ostensibly, but not really, a voluntary basis. And this mass deportation, which forms the basis of my book, Fighting for Dignity, contributed to a major shift in how the Israeli government and the Israeli public talk and think about global migrants. And this is a shift whose impact continues to reverberate today. In analyzing the deportation campaign and its aftermath, my work has explored the changing rhythm and texture and existential demands of everyday life for illegalized migrants from the global south, but especially from Nigeria, Ghana, and the Philippines, as they've struggled to live meaningful and dignified lives while facing the threat of deportation in this fraught socio-political space. And I've explored in particular how illegality is not just a form of legal status and a socio-political condition, but it's also a mode of being in the world that can profoundly affect migrants' experiences of time and space, of the body and moral personhood. And these are themes that are threading through our presentations today. Now, one of my core claims is that this mass deportation campaign hinged on the active and purposeful construction of global migrants as a new kind of other in Israel, who deserved not just relegation to society's margins, where they already were more or less stuck, but also their socio-political abjection. And I want to take care to note that I'm following here British sociologist Imogen Tyler, whose take on the idea of abjection is socio-political and rather than psychodynamic. So specifically, I'm interested in how particular forms of socio-political abjection in Israel are both racialized in ideological and discursive terms, and also embodied in biological and phenomenological terms, often in ways that can endanger people's health, their bodily integrity, and even their lives. Of course, these dynamics need to be historicized and contextualized, and those are tasks that really lie beyond the scope of the time available today. But for now, I ask you to keep in mind that we cannot understand the racialized abjection of global migrants in Israel without confronting Israel's treatment of Palestinians, whom the state treats as its categorically real others, and also the racialized abjection of Jews by the Nazis in 20th century Europe. Now, I approach these questions following 2 decades of ethnographic engagement in Israel and I must acknowledge, from a position of considerable security and privilege. I am a Jewish American anthropologist, born in the US, lived in the region for nearly 5 years. I speak Hebrew, I have close ties with Israeli friends and family. And unlike my migrant friends and research partners, I've been free to enter and leave and move through Israeli space more or less however I pleased, largely because as a 21st century Ashkenazi Jew, I am racialized as white and as potentially Israeli. And of course, these privileges raise challenging epistemological questions, questions of how we know what we know, and also ethical questions about how we gather knowledge and what we do with it. So in the time available, here's what I'd like to do. I want to quickly discuss how Israel became a destination for global migration. I want to introduce what I've come to describe as Israel's local moral economy, and this may be something of an abusive translation, but we'll see what Professor Fasan thinks. And also its relationship, the relationship between this local moral economy to Israel's racialized distinctions between ratified citizens, real others, and this new category of other others. And then I'll introduce you to a woman named Marina, whose story illuminates some of the slipperiness and instability of this new category of otherness in Israel. And then in concluding, I'll connect questions of bodies, borders, and the racialization of otherness to our larger conversation today. So pardon me for telegraphing this very quickly, but essentially, we can break global migration to Israel from the 1990s into three phases, or three waves, if you will. The recruitment of authorized workers to replace Palestinians. This happened in a very quick moment. You can see between 1992 and 2000, the proportion of Palestinians in the Israeli labor market plummeted. And after a period of contentious discussion, the Israeli government authorized the recruitment of migrant workers to replace them in certain sectors, in agriculture and construction. And then the number of documented, authorized migrant workers shot up from virtually nothing to over 100,000 in just a period of a few years. The second movement involves people who came on an unauthorized basis or a spontaneous basis, often through what I've described as the tourist loophole in Israel's migration regime. Essentially, they came as tourists, or quite frequently as Christian religious pilgrims with the intent of staying on. And the third movement, more recent, involves asylum seekers and refugees, especially those arriving from about 2005, 2006, and 7, into about 2013, largely from Sudan and Eritrea, coming overland across the border with Egypt. How did Israel respond to these waves of migration? Well, I've already mentioned the mass deportation campaign that began in 2002. And let me just walk through the mechanics of that campaign quickly. It involved the hiring of about 500 new police officers, the establishment of 4 new detention centers, including one that was, this is quite interesting, was built in what had been a hotel created in anticipation of what was expected to be an influx of Christian pilgrims coming in the year 2000. You might remember, before the year 2000, we were all very anxious about what might happen. In Israel, there was an expectation that everyone would come to celebrate the birth of Jesus, and so new hotels were built. They weren't filled. One of them was turned into a detention center for migrant workers. Other techniques included a media campaign of radio and television ads, trying to seed in the public mind the idea that these migrants were a problem in need of a solution. We also saw the arrest and deportation of migrant leaders, the cultivation of police informers, and a technique that I didn't believe was happening when I first heard about it, but then I saw that there were marks, informers were going and taking a permanent marker and putting marks on the apartment doors of apartments where migrants were living. I saw some of them myself. It was written up in the local paper. I mean, we can spend a lot of time thinking about the resonances of that particular marking of doors, but I'll save that for now. And then I'll just point to one more technique of this campaign, and that involved the invitation to depart on a voluntary basis that I mentioned earlier, and these are some of the flyers that were distributed to try and get people to come to the meeting I described and to get people to sign up and agree to leave the country. And I just want to call your attention, this is hard to read, but on the left-hand poster, part of the appeal of the immigration police was the following: do not let us arrest you. You deserve to leave Israel with dignity. Again, much to discuss. And I don't have time to say much today about Eritrean and Sudanese asylum seekers in Israel, but I do want to make one point. We really can't understand the state's response to these new groups of arrivals without understanding the deportation campaign that's at the center of my book. And let me just show this to you briefly. In 2018, after the Netanyahu government failed in its attempt to deport asylum seekers, the government tried another voluntary departure campaign, this time targeting asylum seekers and offering them money to agree to leave the country and travel to another country. It was eventually made clear that those countries were Rwanda and Uganda. But this was, you know, a sort of technique that reappeared some years later. And I just want to point out quickly the language used here. So the Israeli government has not spoken of asylum seekers as asylum seekers, but rather used this term infiltrators, a term with a lot of history, again, that we could consider. But the language that's used by governments to racialize and exclude is very important. So that's how Israel became a destination for migrants from around the global south through these three waves I've described. Now I want to speak briefly about what I'm calling Israel's local moral economy, which helps us understand these shifting dynamics of racialization and abjection. The notion of a local moral economy, as I've been thinking with it, puts Fassin's early reflections on moral economies in dialogue with another physician anthropologist, Arthur Kleinman's experientially attuned notion of local moral worlds. So we can think of a local moral economy as a shared matrix of historically and culturally particular memories and emotions, values and expectations that establish the parameters of everyday discourse and collective moral reflection, really in relation to a broad range of issues. And an ethnographic window onto a given local moral economy can offer a kind of societal X-ray, a penetrating view of how history, affect, and morality become crystallized in particular principles, sentiments, and concerns that repeat and reoccur in different domains, but in substantially and sometimes radically different ways by different stakeholders. So some key elements of Israel's local moral economy include historical memory of the Shoah or the Holocaust, ideas of security, attention to demography, and what we could think of as a kind of popularized approach to religion. And I'll just give one very quick example of that final point. So Israeli migrant advocates and activists have a piece of the Jewish tradition that they use as a kind of mantra or slogan, this idea that you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress them, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And this is a statement that appears in the Hebrew Bible about 36 times. And then anti-immigrant activists and policymakers also draw on Jewish tradition to make their exclusionary claim. And this is the phrase that typically comes to mind, the poor of your city come first. So we can see how religion is present, but what that means, how it's manifest, can be very different depending on the sort of argument you want to make. So let me carry this forward into thinking about this three-part, essentially division of society, a kind of ethno-national hierarchy that I've introduced. And this ethno-national hierarchy is rooted in two interlinked distinctions, one that juxtaposes Jews and Arabs, and another that differentiates Jews from the broader category of non-Jews. And of course, I'm oversimplifying, but this is really the gist. So following these distinctions, anyone living under Israeli sovereignty is effectively relegated to one of these three groups. Ratified citizens, who are, you know, essentially Jewish Israelis, principally Ashkenazi. Second, the state's purported real others, whose otherness is foundational to the state's and society's self-conception. And here I include Palestinians on both sides of the Green Line. And then finally, the heterogeneous group that I'm describing here as other others, and that includes economic migrants, or, you know, migrants with motives they describe as economic, asylum seekers, victims of human trafficking, and others. Now, while these first two categories have a relatively strong measure of conceptual and discursive stability, the third category is very slippery and unstable, as we could already see in the exchange between Emeka from Nigeria and Rafi of the Immigration Police, and as we see in the story of Marina, a Filipino woman that I met at a clinic for migrant workers, which is one of three migrant advocacy organizations in which I conducted field work as an ethnographer. And when we met, Marina had just given birth to her second child in a Palestinian hospital in Bethlehem. So let me quickly share a bit of Marina's story. "We are shit. We are shit," Marina told me. "Like ants who hide and run away and crawl into the ground to avoid being seen." It was a Friday in January, and we sat side by side on the family bed in her freezing apartment with her 20-month-old daughter playing and trying to capture our attention, and her partner, Raymond, caring for their 5-week-old son, Joey, who had socks on his tiny hands to keep them warm. The day Joey was born, Raymond had been locked up in an Israeli jail, slated for deportation. Now, life in Israel hadn't always been like this for Marina and Raymond. Both had come from the Philippines with visas to work as live-in caregivers for elderly Israelis, and they met while caring for residents of the same building. And though the intimate labors of full-time caregiving were physically and emotionally taxing, both were able to send money homeward regularly, in Marina's case to help educate her younger brothers, and in Raymond's case to his wife and his young daughter. Now, however binding those long-distance ties, the here and now has a power all its own, and before long, Marina was pregnant with their daughter, Eden. With Eden's birth, Marina lost her job, and following Israeli labor policy, also her visa. Now, at this time, before the deportation campaign, illegality had its benefits. Marina and the baby moved into a shared apartment with several other Filipinos and found a live-out position, earning twice what she'd earned with a visa. Raymond continued his live-in job until his visa expired, and after that, he stayed home to care for Eden as primary caregiver. For a time, the family could manage until Marina became pregnant for the second time. And then, in the 9th month of her second pregnancy, the immigration police came looking for Raymond, frightening everyone in their crowded flat and the entire building with their banging. Ignoring Marina's bulging belly and repeated cries of protest, she told me how the officers hit Raymond, handcuffed him, and took him away into the winter night, wearing only a light t-shirt. As the police carted him off, Marina remembered standing at the top of the staircase sobbing, pleading for mercy, and in desperation even threatening suicide. And here's what she told me. "They hit him, they punched him, they kicked him, they took him without nothing. Didn't even ask him to take a jacket over the pajamas. They treat us like a dog, not like a human. Maybe they're the dogs because they treat us like this. They saw that I have a baby, that she was still sleeping. The police was holding me because I'm really trying to kill myself that day. I was thinking, Sarah, if they catch him and send him back, I'm pregnant. And then where can I go? Who's going to help me? This is how criminals are treated. In our country, it's horrible to be a criminal. Criminals murder, things like this. Is he a criminal? How is he a criminal? He just doesn't have a visa." The next morning, their flatmates moved out, leaving Marina alone with a frightened toddler and a rapidly approaching due date. I won't share the story of what happened next, which involved a harrowing late-night journey by minibus, then taxi from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, across a military checkpoint, and then, while having contractions, in another taxi to Bethlehem. But I do want to share one simple detail. The fact is that this time around, Marina hadn't wanted to be pregnant at all. And like other migrant women without access to reproductive health care, racialized abjection became a form of biological tyranny. And like a good number of migrant women I met, Marina resigned herself to biology and carried her unwanted pregnancy to term, the pregnancy that she was too poor and too vulnerable to avoid in the first place. Now, as Marina's story shows, and as I elaborate more fully in my book, migrants' experiences of racial borders, or borrowing Tendaya Chiume's formulation, their experience as racial borders, involves complex tales of dignity, or more specifically, the pursuit of dignity, of indignity, and also of indignation. Now, before I conclude, I want to bring in just one more voice from a Ghanaian woman I'll call Supi, who shared this as a kind of side comment at another very interesting meeting, this time a meeting of African community leaders who had invited an Israeli human rights activist I'll call Yael to offer guidance on how to minimize their risk of arrest and deportation. And here's what Supi said after Yael described some of the disturbing and, in some cases, violent arrests that had recently been reported to the organization that she helped found, an organization called the Hotline for Migrants and Refugees. Supi said, "I'm not for the bombings. I think they're wrong. But if this is what Israelis do in the center, where everyone can see, just think of what they must be doing to the Palestinians in the bush, where no one can see." So much is striking about Supi's comments, but there's one point I'd like to draw out in particular. One difference between what I've described as Palestinians' real otherness and global migrants' other otherness stems from the Israeli government's presumption that global migrants have no particular stake in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Or, if pressed, that migrants would, in fact, align themselves with Israel. Now, during the deportation campaign and long after, I've generally found this to be true, and I rarely heard migrant workers think through the racialization of both bodies and borders, of people and also space, in quite the way Supi did here. What her comment offers us is actually a powerful example of how we can test and perhaps stretch our own moral imaginations by thinking things together, categories, distinctions, moral logics, that are generally kept cordoned off from one another. And so to conclude, the mass deportation campaign I've described, which again marked a definitive moment in Israel's treatment of global migrants, was in many respects typical of contemporary deportation regimes. We're hearing that today, right? A state deems certain migrants' presence a problem and then draws on a familiar arsenal of tactics and techniques, many of them embedded in logics of racial exclusion with deep historical roots, and then uses those techniques and tactics to humiliate, to criminalize, and to expel those who've been defined as other. And yet, Emeka and Officer Rafi, Marina, and Supi help us see that deportation regimes and the racial borders they enforce are also deeply localized, their logic and expression deeply particular. By naming and tracing unspoken, if not invisibilized, structural logics of inequality and exclusion, I've sought to illuminate one racialized socio-political hierarchy among many, and to show how it can be embodied and experienced. And in addition, I've sought to illuminate the ethical stakes of seeing and naming political arrangements and modes of abjection that are not mere abstractions, but involve powerful and often violent incursions into the lives of real people. And like my friend Tali Kritzmann Amir, I reject claims that those who pursue this kind of intellectual work are out of touch, unrealistic, or naive, or immature. And if we take our intellectual work out of the academy and into the world, what could be more important than working to achieve what Hannah Arendt described as a society in which each of us can live in a framework where we are judged according to who and not what we are, and be treated as a person based on our words and deeds, and not merely our membership in a category? Or what the Israeli philosopher Avishai Margalit describes as a society that does not humiliate. So my hope is that in recognizing these logics, and despite all of the structures and ideologies so meticulously crafted to obscure our shared humanity, we might follow Supi in the strange and difficult work of stretching our moral imagination, and perhaps allowing that imagination to help us find new ways of seeing, being, and acting in the world. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.